Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has served on the court for more than 30 years. For all of those 30 years, and even before he was a Supreme Court Justice, he was considered by the left in America a somewhat controversial character. Why is that, and what is his real legacy and judicial philosophy? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Independence Day, Monday afternoon, the 4th of July. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the remarkable work and life of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas with Mark Paoletta, co-editor of a new book, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. Then in hour two, we'll look forward to Sunday morning talking with Pastor David Peterson about Jesus' warning about judging others in Luke chapter 6. Mark Paoletta formerly served as general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget and as chief counsel and assistant to Vice President Mike Pence. He's senior fellow at the Center for Renewing America and co-editor of the new book, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
How would you describe Clarence Thomas's influence on the Supreme Court over the last 30 plus years?
Monumental, the most significant appointment to the Supreme Court in a generation, if not longer. I believe he's our greatest justice. I believe that his dissents and concurrences are becoming majority opinions, and that in a larger sense, he has reframed the kind of the judicial landscape, both by the force of his arguments and his principled stands, and that there are many, many law students and now lawyers, and those lawyers becoming judges, and many of them his former law clerks, that are out there in the vineyards, if you will, applying his jurisprudence, which is originalism and textualism, to judicial decision making. And then obviously his life story and the principled stands and courage that he has exemplified are also impacting both our larger discourse, but also the judicial realm.
How do you explain progressive politicians and the media's criticisms of Justice Thomas throughout his time on the court?
Well, I think the criticisms of Justice Thomas began, and attacks and smears, began actually when he sort of came to town and joined the Reagan administration. And it's a continuation of it. It's just he's continuing to do his job, and now he's on the Supreme Court. And that is essentially grounded in the view that he is required to have certain views as a black man. And if he has other views, he's going to be censored and destroyed. And because Justice Thomas, then Clarence Thomas, EEOC chairman, assistant secretary of the Department of Education under the Reagan administration, had views that didn't align with essentially the black leadership, he has been attacked and attacked and attacked. And when you don't sing from their song sheet, then they attack you and they disparage you. And so there's been this continual attack that Justice Thomas is, you know, they use these vile words like an Uncle Tom, or that he isn't up to doing the job, and they disparage him both before he got on the court and certainly on the court. But what he's done is he's literally just showed up for work every day and written the most opinions of any justice by far on the Supreme Court year in and year out, 3 times the number of some of the other justices. So that's what it is essentially, is that he's not conforming to what they think a black man should be thinking. And that's the most racist thing you can imagine.
So you mentioned his life story. What's notable about Justice Thomas's childhood and upbringing?
Sure. So Justice Thomas was born in 1948 in the Deep South during segregation, state enforced segregation, horrible. And he was born to uneducated parents, and the father left the family when he was 2 years old. His mom was a maid who went to work, I think at 9 years old, picking crabs and working in an oyster factory, I think for something like 9 cents an hour. And it was a really tough time. And you know, the environment he was born into kind of was hopeless in terms of coming out of it and rising through society. And it was a, as Justice Thomas has described it, it was rural poverty and certainly under segregation, but it had a community that was self-supporting, but was uneducated. Most of his family and relatives were illiterate, and that the two sort of seminal events in his life. So, as I said, he was born in 48 in a little shanty in a house on the water in Pinpoint, Georgia, which is about 20 miles outside of Savannah, Georgia. Like, as I said, in a shanty with no electricity, but for one light bulb hanging in the middle of the room, no indoor plumbing, holes in the walls that you filled in with newspaper. And he's wandering around the streets of Savannah when he's in second grade because his mom is working as a maid and sometimes staying at these folks' home. And he's got two other siblings. And she can't raise her kids and she's having difficulty. And then the little shanty where Clarence Thomas is living burns down and he goes to live with his mom in Savannah. And when he's 7 years old, she goes to his grandfather, her father, and asks him to help raise Clarence Thomas, the grandfather and the grandmother. And he goes to live in this home in Savannah, just a couple blocks from where his mom had this, was living in a tenement. And that's where his life changes completely. His grandfather is a strict disciplinarian who has made his way in the segregated South with his own business. He had a fuel oil business. And he was taught, you know, the day that Clarence Thomas and his brother Myers show up to live there, his grandfather says, "Boys, the damn vacation is over. It's going to be rules and regulations from now on." And it's this tough love where he's going to get his grandsons ready for this tough world that they're entering. And he's going to hold them to high standards and he's not going to allow any excuses. And he had this saying, "Old man Kant is dead." And so he worked on his father's fuel oil business after school, going out on the truck and delivering fuel oil to this community. And then during the summer times, they lived out on a farm where his grandfather had some property and they built a house from scratch. And Clarence and his brother Myers worked there from sun to sun, as he said, doing farming chores and the like. The other seminal event that happened is his grandfather enrolled him in a Catholic school, the all-black segregated Catholic school called St. Benedict's in Savannah when Clarence was in the second grade. And again, these were nuns from Ireland. They were called terrible words because they were teaching the black students down there during segregation. But again, tough love, but accountability and teaching them that they were all equal in God's eyes, that they were equal, even though there was this terrible segregation, and got them ready for the world, held them to high standards, and made them learn their math, learn English, learn all the subjects to get them ready so that they could go out into the world and succeed. And he is a living testament, and he has said this many, many times, to his grandparents, and particularly his grandfather. His memoirs is called My Grandfather's Son, and the Irish nuns who taught him at St. Benedict's.
Justice Thomas famously has a bust of his grandfather on display in his chambers. What lessons does he believe he learned from his grandfather?
Perseverance, integrity, work ethic, a belief in this country. You know, his grandfather and his grandmother grew up in the segregated South and had a vision that if they worked hard and practiced their faith, his grandfather was a Catholic convert to Catholicism, that they were doing the right thing. And I think that has stuck with Justice Thomas. And you're right, there is this bust that his wife had made for him that sits high atop his chambers in the Supreme Court. And it has the phrase I mentioned before, which is, "Old man Kant is dead, I helped bury him." And it's a great testament and tribute to his grandfather. And I think those are the lessons he learned. I think he says at the end of the book, you know, "I want to be able to say to my grandfather when I see him, I did my job. I did it the best I could." So he's every day impacted and influenced by his grandfather and his lessons. And as you may recall in the book, there's a time during Justice Thomas's career where he's really getting beaten up and he's really down. And his grandfather passes away. It's 1983. And he comes back up and he thinks about what his life's about and how he's living it, and he's kind of down. And he dedicates his life to living by the principles and being willing to die for the principles of his grandfather. And that's what he sets his sights on doing from that period forward.
Why did Thomas leave study for the priesthood and turn to law?
He, as I said, he was enrolled in St. Benedict's, where he was an altar boy. And I think he liked that life. He loved prayers and the Catholic Church and its, I'll call them, rituals. And he grew up in that environment. I think it's a natural thing to want to aspire to for a young man. And when he asked his grandfather about going to the seminary, you know, because it was a boarding school, and this would be for high school, it's called a minor seminary, and it was called St. John Vianney Minor Seminary in the Isle of Hope, right outside of Savannah. And his grandfather said, if you go, you can't quit, and don't shame the race. And this was Justice Thomas going into, for the first time, into an environment where there were almost all white students. You know, this was segregation. Segregation was just ending in Savannah. So Clarence Thomas and one other student were the first black students to enter St. John Vianney. And after the next year, that other student had dropped out. So it was just Clarence Thomas. And it was difficult to be in that environment and be basically a pathbreaker into that world. And he had, you know, he talks about some stories that were racist, sort of insults or actions that really kind of scarred him, and how he dealt with them by going to pray and, you know, looking to the Lord for patience and strength. But he excels there. And by the end, I think he entered with a class of something like 27 students, and it got down to 9, I think, by the time they graduated. And that group of students were very close and had become close to good friends with Justice Thomas. And famously, in the documentary Created Equal, there's this inscription in Justice Thomas's yearbook that says, blew that test, only got a 98. And it just showed Justice Thomas was driven to succeed. I think when he went to the major seminary, which is like college, and there were some more racial slights, and also I think he thought the Catholic Church wasn't doing enough to address racism and the inequities in our society in that regard, and became disillusioned, and it kind of reached its breaking point when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and he heard one of the seminarians say, I hope that SOB dies. And literally at that moment, Justice Thomas says, he lost his vocation for good. He was having questions about it and wondering what he should do, but that was when it broke. And he quit the seminary that year. It would have been his first year in college in the seminary, and went home. And like his father said, if you go to the seminary, you can't quit. His father kicked him out of the house that he had gone to when he was 7 years old. And now he was back living with his mother in this little tenement and sort of kind of lost and disillusioned. And at this point, this is 68, the summer of 68, Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. Justice Thomas, as he says in the book, in the movie, he kind of lost his battle with the beast. And at that point, as he says, race and racism explained everything. And he turned to sort of radicalism and went up to Holy Cross and became a member of the Black Student Union and did a bunch of protesting and turned away essentially from his grandfather's principles, the principles of his of the nuns from St. Benedict's.
Talk about his time at Yale.
Well, his time at Yale, I think it was such a culture shock. I think it's the first time, you know, he's up at Holy Cross, which is a working class school and obviously a Catholic school, a Jesuit school. And as he says, Justice Thomas, the priests there who ran the school were liberal, and he was probably more liberal than them at the time, but they demanded excellence from you, no excuses. And when he got to Yale, I think he just didn't fit in to the whole culture of sort of the secret societies and the landed gentry, if you will. And as he says, the liberal scourge of thinking that you're not qualified to be there, you know, and that you're only admitted because you're black. And as he says, coming out of Yale, he couldn't find a job because, you know, this idea, and he did not have affirmative action getting into Yale. You know, he did well at Yale, but because of the policies, because of the culture there, and when looking for a job, he couldn't find a job and ended up in a sort of a silver lining way, going to work for Jack Danforth. But he worked at the New Haven Legal Assistance Program his entire 3 years at Yale. And what's interesting is, you know, Justice Thomas has always been, what are the real sort of practical implications of what you're doing? He doesn't like people who are just theorists or have big ideas in the sky that they're going to fit in to kind of everyday life, no matter what the reality is. And I think he saw that a lot at Yale. It was his first taste of it. And I think he didn't like those people who just kind of sit in their ivory towers and come up with, oh, here's a great policy for social programs, but we don't really know how it works, but we're going to feel good that we're coming up with this. And working at New Haven Legal Assistance and working with people day in and day out on their problems, I think was a real education and sort of set his kind of view that let's look at what's really happening. Let's not have these kind of high-minded ideas that don't really work and actually do harm to the folks that you're trying to help. And of course, he also had a child by this point. He was married right after he graduated from Holy Cross. And he's looking at the world differently because he has this child, Jamal. And issues like busing, which he talks about in the movie, in the book, that this idea of busing students is absurd and was not helping anybody and was just kind of feeding this liberal narrative that somehow it's going to help when it didn't help anybody.
Talk about the influence of Thomas Sowell on Justice Thomas.
When Justice Thomas first read Thomas Sowell, he said he threw the book away because no black man could think that way. But then once he, and this is, I think, in Yale, but when he goes to work for Jack Danforth out in St. Louis in the Attorney General's office and is kind of working, has hundreds and hundreds of cases pouring in, and he loves it out there. It's one of his favorite jobs. And certainly, I think he's called Jack Danforth his best boss ever because it was just merit and it was in the Midwest and just doing your job. And he is beginning to read and coming away from his radicalism. And, you know, he's searching, which is just Justice Thomas's kind of mode always. And to this day, when I talk to him, he's reading something different almost every week or in depth on some topic, which he'll spend several months on, and then he'll move to something else. And I think you see this with his time out there. And he kind of, there's a colleague of his who tells him about this book that's just been published by Thomas Sowell. And he reads it and he says it was like water in the desert. He drank it up. It was exactly what he was thinking. And here was a man who was articulating exactly what Clarence was coming to believe. And that is, at the end of the day, this no-nonsense. What are the facts? How do things really work? Testing out the theories and what really, really happens with policies and looking at the data to see if they're working or they're not, and being sort of unforgiving with that data. And that's what Thomas Sowell is. I think Clarence Thomas talks about him as the most honest man. And so he's a huge impact on Justice Thomas. They're friends today. There was just a conference actually down in Dallas that Justice Thomas spoke at that was honoring Thomas Sowell in Old Parkland. And as you'll recall, Thomas Sowell invited Clarence Thomas to come to a conference in December of 1980, called the Fairmont Conference, which was a number of black conservatives getting together at the beginning of the Reagan administration, just before 1981, Ronald Reagan comes in, to talk about revisiting the kind of social policies and solutions and what could be better in terms of helping the black community. And Clarence Thomas attended that conference and spoke at it. And then 40 years later, he's speaking at this one again. So it was kind of a neat closing of the circle. But Thomas Sowell, monumentally important to Justice Thomas, both I think as a in terms of his ideas, but also his courage to never back down. Because as you know, Thomas Sowell has been pilloried for his work, and he just goes on and keeps writing and doing his work, come what may.
You mentioned John Danforth. Talk about the role that he played in directing Thomas's path.
Jack Danforth is a great man. I got to know Senator Danforth during the confirmation. He was, of course, born into incredible wealth. I think when he interviewed Clarence Thomas, he had just been elected the Republican Attorney General in Missouri in 1972, and he was looking for young lawyers to come work for him. And he had gone to Yale, and I think it was through Guido Calabresi, who was a famous professor at Yale, who later became a judge. But I think Danforth reached out to Calabresi saying, I'm coming to town. I'd love to talk to some of the students. And through that, Justice Thomas was connected up with Jack Danforth. And when they sat down in New Haven, Jack Danforth said something like, "I was born with a platinum spoon in my mouth," or something like that, and told Clarence, "There's room at the top, and I'll pay you less money for more work of anybody out there." And they really hit it off. And at this point, Justice Thomas is still a Democrat and is kind of looking at Jack Danforth in a bemused way, but goes in, and it was the only job offer he got, as he says, and went out to Jefferson City, Missouri to work for Jack Danforth. And just an ethical, principled guy who Justice Thomas loved working for. It was a great role model. And as once he comes to Washington and he ends up working for Jack Danforth. So Jack Danforth, he's working for him as in the Attorney General's office. Jack Danforth then gets elected to the U.S. Senate. Justice Thomas had left the AG's office and went to go work for Monsanto for a couple years. Didn't really like it. He thought it was kind of boring and it didn't have a lot of work. And just by happenstance, he, you know, connects back up with Jack Danforth, who's now in the U.S. Senate, and offers Clarence a job to be a legislative assistant in Washington, D.C. So Thomas comes to work for Danforth to do energy and environment work in Washington in 78, 79. And then Thomas goes into the Reagan administration to do these jobs. But obviously, once he gets nominated to the Supreme Court, it's Senator Danforth who plays an incredibly key role in getting Justice Thomas confirmed as the senator, you know, who's going to move heaven and earth to help get Justice Thomas confirmed.
Talk about Thomas's time in the Reagan administration. It wasn't an easy time for him, was it?
No, you know, well, it's interesting. It wasn't an easy time because when he came in, the Black civil rights leadership, you know, mercilessly attacked him and the Democrats up on the Hill. The Congress was run by Democrats. I think Thomas had something like 60 oversight hearings. He first went into the Department of Education and then he moved over to be the chairman of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And it's from there when he is there that he gets nominated in 1990 to be on the DC circuit and then up to the Supreme Court. But he's battling the civil rights groups all during the time and he's working for the Reagan administration. So they're just attacking him. But he's also having his battles with the Reagan administration folks who think he's not moving fast enough or he's not doing things in a way that is making them happy. And so he's getting it from both sides. And you see Justice Thomas again. The worst thing you can ever do is try and tell Justice Thomas what to do because he will, you know, he's a fiercely independent guy on anything. And so I think the Reagan administration folks kind of learned that. And obviously the civil rights folks learned that too. And he listened to both sides and implemented what he thought was the proper way to go on various things. He built a good staff at the EEOC in particular. He turned it around. It was an agency that was absolutely broken. They had no paperwork system. It was a flea-infested, disgusting building that the GAO had lambasted before Thomas had gotten there as just being a complete wreck. And it was run by Eleanor Holmes Norton, of course, who went on to become a congresswoman representative from the District of Columbia and is still there. But it was an absolute mess. And Clarence Thomas really kind of dug into making the agency function and getting electronic systems and getting the record keeping in place and building into a, you know, an agency that by the time he left the Washington Post, or even before he left, Washington Post had written some great editorials about the job Clarence Thomas was doing there. And in fact, there was a plaque when Justice Thomas left that the career employees at the EEOC had made, which it was at the front of the building and it's still in their new building, you know, thanking him for his amazing service at that agency for many years. And as a testament to him that it wasn't Republican, Democrat, they liked a boss who dug in and understood the issues and worked side by side with them. He was the chairman and he was going to drive that place, somebody who respected them. But yeah, he was under attack constantly during his time in the Reagan administration. And I think it toughened him up. And when the Bush administration is looking at him to be a judge, I think that's something forefront in their mind is here's a guy who's been under attack and under fire for many, many years. And that's a great indication of how they're going to be, you know, when they're under fire as a judge.
If you would, at this time, his view of the law is changing a little bit. What shaped his view of natural law?
Well, as he says in his book, he was looking for something that said that slavery is wrong. and the Declaration of Independence in forming the Constitution, and that these are God-given rights, which our country was founded on, and having that sort of inform, you know, that all men are created equal, and that's informing the Constitution. So I think it's nothing more than that. And I think when he went to the EEOC, and after he sort of got it in shape, he hired these two political scientists, PhD individuals, Ken Masugi and John Marini, who helped him dig into our founding documents and kind of get a sense of what the founders were creating and how it would be implemented. And I think it's essentially, as he has said in the movie, a governing philosophy that all men are created equal and that slavery is wrong.
Describe Thomas's path from the Reagan administration to the U.S. Supreme Court.
He's at the EEOC. He gets reappointed to the EEOC in 1986. And I think those are four-year terms for a chairman. So he's going to go through the Reagan years, right? The end of Reagan is 88. And so George Bush comes in. I'm in the Bush 41. This is Bush 41 White House. And the White House is interested in appointing Clarence Thomas to the D.C. Circuit. And I had met Clarence Thomas back in 83 at some event. But in any event, I'm part of the Judicial Selection Committee in the White House. And I reach out to him and ask him for all of his writings, his, you know, speeches and articles and the like, so that we could review his work, just do our due diligence on what he has said and what he thinks and all that kind of stuff. Would he be a good candidate to be on the D.C. Circuit? And so we obviously loved his work and very interested in appointing him. And so, in fact, President Bush appointed him to the D.C. Circuit in 1990. And then he does a great job. He's only there on the D.C. Circuit for a short time. The interesting thing is President Bush had wanted to appoint Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court when Brennan retired in 1990. Justice Thomas would have only been on the bench for a short time. But I think what President Bush saw in Clarence Thomas was essentially the best of America and actually the best person who could be a judge, which is you have courage and you're going to rule based on the meaning of the Constitution, the original meaning of the Constitution and the text of the statute. And you have that humility that you're not going to try and set aside those documents, those laws to impose your own vision. And that's the most important thing about being a judge or justice. And I think President Bush saw that from the get-go on Clarence Thomas. So he serves about 18 months in the D.C. Circuit when Thurgood Marshall resigns from the Supreme Court. Then President Bush, you know, nominates Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court July 1st of 1991.
We're talking about the life and work of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas with Mark Paoletta, co-editor of the new book Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. On the other side, how does Thomas remember the Anita Hill accusations and the Senate confirmation hearings? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Making Disciples for Life. Across the nation, students are back in school in over 1,800 schools serving children in early childhood through high school. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in a safe, caring, Christian environment taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Connect today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family at lcms.org/schools.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc. Times of war have caused people throughout history to ask questions about the existence of God and the existence of evil. And yet we must confess that even amidst the terrors of war, God remains God. Nothing happens that he does not, at the very least, allow. If you've wondered these very things, especially as you've watched the war in Ukraine, you might find some of the answers you're looking for in the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, Church and State in a Time of War. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe, or our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Memoria Press exists to promote and impart the classical heritage of the Christian West through an emphasis on the liberal arts and the great works of the Western tradition. The Memoria Press curriculum encourages the development of wisdom and virtue through the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR22. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com.
Mark Paoletta is our guest, formerly served as General Counsel to the Office of Management and Budget and as Chief Counsel and Assistant to Vice President Mike Pence. The Senior Fellow at the Center for Renewing America. We're talking about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. How does Thomas remember the Anita Hill accusations and the Senate confirmation hearings?
I think he remembers them as the most despicable thing you can do to a person, which is to drum up false allegations to destroy him, and not just kind of stop his confirmation, but to destroy him as a human being, and that this should have never happened. As you may recall, he called it a circus and a national disgrace. You know, Thomas had been nominated on July 1st, 1991. And from the get-go, there was just smear upon smear during the summer trying to say he was a wife beater, he was a tax cheat, he had a Confederate flag on his desk, all these crazy things that all turned out to be false and provably so. And then the Hill allegations appear after, so Thomas had his hearings in September before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then Anita Hill makes these allegations that Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her, or in her words, actually said he talked about pornographic films and pressed her for dates and that sort of thing. And the strange thing about it is, so this happens sort of after his first set of hearings when the committee's about to vote on his nomination and he's headed for a full vote in the Senate. And she makes these 11th hour accusations that the Senate looks at. They send the FBI out to do an investigation, and Senator Biden, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee at the time, they look at the file, they look at the people who were interviewed and decide this isn't worth doing anything more on. We don't think anything's there. And they're going to go ahead and take the vote. And then somebody leaks it because, in my view, a Democratic staffer and a Democratic senator leak Anita Hill's accusations publicly. And obviously, as Justice Thomas says, all heck breaks loose. And we have the Hill-Thomas hearings. What's interesting about, again, Anita Hill's accusations is that she said that she was working for Clarence Thomas at the Department of Education when he first supposedly did this. And then when he gets appointed to the EEOC, so he's literally going to leave the agency, the Department of Education, and go to another agency, you'd think somebody who was being sexually harassed would be happy that the harasser is leaving. But no, she follows him. And by all accounts, everyone said she was very excited to go with Justice Thomas over to the EEOC. And then she claims that he had stopped for a while, and then he starts up again at the EEOC, and then she leaves shortly thereafter. The only problem with their story is it didn't add up in any way. And the witnesses that testified, not a single person who worked with Thomas and Hill at either Department of Education or at the EEOC believed Hill. And all the witnesses who testified, and you know, the Democrats were running this, so if there was anybody who wanted to come forward, they would have. But all the witnesses that testified supported, that worked together with them, supported Justice Thomas and said Anita Hill was not telling the truth. Many of them literally said that. She had some witnesses that she called, four of them that were very weak. And the main witness, who she originally said was the only person she had told, literally says that she had been talking to Anita Hill at a time about this supposed harassment when Anita Hill hadn't even begun working for Clarence Thomas. And so there are all things like that. Her continuing to call Clarence Thomas once she left the EEOC. She had 12 phone calls on a phone log. She lied about whether she had called Clarence Thomas. And then we produced the logs that showed that she had called Justice Thomas many, many times after she had left the EEOC and gone to teach in Oklahoma. And so by the end of those hearings, and they were riveting, everyone in America were watching them, and they broadcast them live on every channel and every TV station. So people got to see them unfiltered and make their own assessments. And at the end of those hearings, the New York Times CBS poll had the American people believing Clarence Thomas 58% to 24%. And that held true with women too. So her allegations were judged to be not true. And so Thomas was confirmed. And as we remember, he came out during those hearings and called it a high-tech lynching, which was just, I thought, spot on and blew up the Senate in terms of him calling them out for what they were doing to him. But at the end of the day, as I said, it was 58 to 24 that the American people believed that Thomas is telling the truth, and conversely, that Hill was lying.
How does he remember then Senator Biden's handling of those hearings, especially the hearings that were later televised, which attempted to portray Thomas in such a negative light?
Yeah, he thought he handled them awful, that he was weak, and that he was willing to basically lie to take down Clarence Thomas and make the folks who were trying to destroy Thomas happy. And I say that because when these allegations were first made and they did this investigation and they looked at him, Justice Thomas had a conversation with Senator Biden when he said, "I don't know how you're going to vote on this, but all I want to make sure is that I keep my good name." And this is sort of after the investigation and the FBI had already looked at this. And Biden said, "I will be there for you and I will defend your good name. Don't worry about it. I may vote against you because of your judicial philosophy, but on that score, on this part, I'm going to defend your integrity." You're referencing, obviously, the Hill-Thomas hearing. So I think he thinks that they should have never been public. They had an investigation. Her allegations had been adjudged to be not credible. And, you know, this is kind of very, as he said, sensitive stuff. And these sorts of allegations you should have investigated if people make them. But to sprawl it out on television and to have it leaked and just have these spurious allegations about you was just, I think, in his view, un-American. It was just disgusting. It had been said a little bit back in the beginning of the hearings when Biden had told Thomas, "I'll give you a softball for the first questions just so you get your feet." And this is the first set of hearings, not the Anita Hill hearings. And in fact, he came up with some warped, disjointed quote that Thomas had said, but he left off the last part of it. So it changed the meaning of it entirely and really threw Clarence Thomas literally when the hearings first started. So we cleaned that up, showed Justice Thomas what the whole quote was and why what Biden was representing was just wrong or misleading. And so from then on, obviously, Justice Thomas was very, very wary of Joe Biden and his assurances of how he would be treated fairly. And the other thing is, when Justice Thomas was confirmed, Joe Biden left him a message, a voicemail that said, "Congratulations, don't let this get you down. You have 30 years to show the American people what you are, a person of integrity. And if you had believed Anita Hill, you certainly wouldn't be making a phone call and leaving a message like that." And there's also evidence that Joe Biden didn't believe Anita Hill during those hearings. Senator Hatch is on record in a documentary saying Biden told him he didn't believe Anita Hill. Senator Spector interviewed Joe Biden, and Joe Biden told him on record, on tape, that he didn't believe Anita Hill on this key allegation. So there's lots of contemporaneous evidence that Biden didn't believe her at the time, but he went ahead with these hearings. Of course, when he decided to run for president, he then changed his tune and said he always believed Anita Hill, and that's just a lie. But I think Justice Thomas thought he was treated in a terrible way, in an unjust way, smearing not just him, but his family, and obviously making his wife go through these terrible hearings. I don't think his views have changed in 31 years.
So you had mentioned the terms originalist or textualist. How does Thomas describe his own judicial philosophy?
I think it's pretty simple. You know, this originalism is discerning. Now, it's simple in terms of the approach. The work you do is, I think, very discerning and there's a lot to be done in digging. But it's you look at the original meaning of the words of the Constitution and you're looking at sources around the document if it's unclear and being faithful. At the end of the day, it's about being faithful to what the original meaning is of the Constitution and not substituting your judgment for what you want it to be. And you really have to be honest in that. And he really goes out of his way in the book to talk about this. You know, you really have to be honest with how you're doing it. You could say you're doing that, but if you really want to substitute your judgment and you're trying to find a way to come up with something that will support your preordained decision, that's not being faithful to your oath or to originalism. Textualism is just, it's a statute instead of the Constitution. And what did the text of the statute say? Justice Thomas uses, again, in a very relatable way, and this is why he's so, in my view, influential when he explains these things. He says, you know, there's a stop sign. It says stop. You might think it's just, you know, stupid to have a stop sign here on this road or at this corner, but it says stop. And words have to have a meaning for us to communicate. And if you try and turn it into a pretzel, the meaning of a word or the text of a statute, that's when we're in trouble. So it's being, at the end of the day, honest in your review of those words that you're trying to apply to the facts at hand. And you may look at the debates, or you may look at documents, you may look at what this word meant at the time of the ratification of the Constitution to understand and get your best sense of what the original meaning is. But at the end of the day, I think it's an attitude of faithfulness and humility, because there are some originalists, as we see sometimes, who come to a different conclusion. But if you're doing it honestly, that's, I think, the most important thing in Justice Thomas's view of how you're carrying out your job.
Why is the 2003 case, Grutter versus Bollinger, so important in understanding Justice Thomas?
Yeah, it's his dissent where it's just Justice Thomas looking at, this is a University of Michigan case on affirmative action, and Justice Thomas, I think, calling out, one, saying affirmative action is not sanctioned by the Constitution. Discriminating on the basis of race is not constitutional. And he says, show me in the Constitution where it says you can treat the races differently, and that people become very comfortable saying that, oh, I'm doing this for good reasons. I'm discriminating for a positive reason. And there's just there's no rhyme or reason. There's no justification for ever discriminating, white or black, and try and dress it up for noble reasons. So Justice Thomas walks through all the problems with both constitutionally and kind of policy-wise that these schools want to be elite and open to everyone. And you just can't have both. And, you know, there's other ways to bring in, if you want to have a diverse student body, you can lower your standards. It may be a great thing to have, you know, and it goes across the boards. It's not just, I think Justice Thomas views affirmative action as if it's done properly, you avoid, as he says, the constitutional issues. You can do it for white and black, you know, lower socioeconomic people who need preparation to be able to excel in a school. And he thinks the worst thing is when you have this mismatch. Again, students who are not ready, they may be very talented, they may be very smart, white or black, but because of their environment in which they were born in, grown up in, they're not ready. And to say we're going to give extra points based on race and put somebody in a setting where it's going to be very, very difficult for them to succeed is selfish in not helping the student. It's actually harming the student. And Justice Thomas, again, it sort of goes back to this Thomas Sowell. What is going on here? And why are people making these policies or pursuing these goals when in fact they're harming people? And it goes back to, again, constitutionally in Grutter writing the dissent that this is not constitutional.
It's often reported that Justice Thomas is quiet during oral argument. Is that true?
So Justice Thomas has always said that what he didn't like about oral argument in the modern age, and I'll amend that in a second, but when he first came on the court for many, many years, I think he thought of the justices, many justices, sort of playing a gotcha game with the lawyer who's making his case before the Supreme Court, and that it wasn't serving a function of learning or gathering information. It was just to score points, either against the lawyer making the argument or against the other justices on the bench who may have had a different view. So it was kind of this sort of game and kind of showing off and not really designed to elicit useful information. Justice Thomas thinks that you should be able to make your case as a litigant before the Supreme Court and walk out saying, hey, I got to make my argument. And win or lose, I got to make my argument. So for many years, Justice Thomas didn't ask a lot of questions in oral argument because he just thought it was a cacophony of voices that it was not useful. When COVID happened and they went virtual, Chief Justice Roberts instituted a policy where each justice went in order by seniority. You know, because in the normal time, you know, sort of in the regular process, anyone could jump in at any time. So the lawyer could start, and within a minute of his presentation, somebody could pop in with a question, and then another justice might jump in. But when COVID happened and they moved remote, Roberts instituted this policy where he's going to call on each justice by seniority. And literally every oral argument since then, Justice Thomas has asked the first question and several questions and on second rounds. And so it's reflective of his view that it wasn't that he didn't like to ask questions. It was that the manner in which it was being carried out was not useful. Now, the way it's being done, he asks a question at every oral argument. So that I've always taken that criticism of Justice Thomas as being racist. Again, attacking Justice Thomas for not being qualified for the court or being reliant on Justice Scalia, absolute racist sort of attacks on him. When Justice Thomas has written the most opinions of any justice year in and year out for many, many, many years. Justice Thomas writes something like 30 to 39 opinions per year when many of the other justices, nobody comes close to that. I think the next closest is in the 20s, and a lot of them are in the teens. And some of the justices only write 10 opinions per year. So at the end of the day, the job of a justice of the Supreme Court is to rule on cases and write opinions. And Justice Thomas has written the most opinions by far year in and year out of justices. This year, of course, as the court becomes, you know, more aligned with his views, the other justices that are joining the court, he has the most majority opinions, I believe, this year. And it's a testament to him that for all these many years, he's been standing by his principles and his principled approach to the court and judicial decision making. And justices are now beginning to join him. There was a case earlier this year, I think it was this term, where it was a 6-3 Thomas opinion, and Justice Sotomayor, in dissent, she's one of the three, wrote, "This issue a few years ago only had one vote for this position, which was Justice Thomas. How did it become 6-3 in this short of a time?" And again, I think it was a testament to, it was a First Amendment case, it was a testament to Justice Thomas's, as we talked about at the beginning, influence on the Supreme Court and on our jurisprudence.
Roe v. Wade has been an issue for Thomas's entire tenure on the court. How would you describe his role in seeing that decision possibly overturned?
So, going back to my comments, I mean, Justice Thomas in 1992 joined a dissent in Casey to overturn and explicitly saying Roe v. Wade should be overturned. I think he's written maybe 5 or 6 opinions since then when the court's taken it up, saying that Roe v. Wade is a monstrosity that should be overturned. It has no basis in our Constitution at all, talking about sort of original meaning and his approach to the Constitution. There is no right to an abortion anywhere to be found in the United States Constitution. Legislature should make that decision at the state level. So he has devoted a substantial amount of time when the court has taken up these cases to writing very powerfully on both the horrors of abortion and also how it has no place in our Constitution in terms of a right to an abortion. What's really interesting here, and I think, again, is a testament to Justice Thomas and his humility, is that he is the senior justice, at least as according to the Dobbs, you know, leaked draft, which is had 5 justices on it. And the senior justice in the majority or the minority is the justice who can take that opinion and write it himself or assign it to another justice in that group. Chief Justice Roberts was not in that group of 5. So Clarence Thomas, as the senior justice on the court, was the person who was had the power as to who was going to write that opinion. And he could have written it himself. And I would say there are other justices up there, if they were in that role, would have kept that opinion for themselves and written it. But Justice Thomas, you know, on one of the most consequential opinions that's going to come down for some time, assigned it to his friend Sam Alito to write the opinion. And I think Alito did a spectacular job based on the leaked opinion, which has been, you know, they've said is authentic. And so it just goes to the humility of Justice Thomas that he didn't feel the need to write it himself. We'll see if he writes a concurrence and whether there are other concurrences in that opinion. And hopefully it holds with the 5 and the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade in the next couple of weeks. So I think it's his own writings in the abortion area have been powerful and influential, but I also think it's his courage in voting what he believes is the right answer, come what may, that has helped give courage and strength, or given help to the courage and strength of the other justices on the Supreme Court. Because as we're seeing right now, the Supreme Court is under attack as never before. It's astonishing, actually, you know, that there are assassination attempts on Supreme Court justices. Again, all over this opinion, Roe v. Wade from 1973, which really sort of warped the court and our jurisprudence and, in fact, our politics and our governing, because it's become an issue that just transformed everything, including every confirmation hearing since then. But Justice Thomas has been a bright light, a steady light in this area. Hopefully, those five justices are going to stick with that opinion and issue it next couple of weeks.
Thomas's critics have renewed calls for him to resign over allegations or alleged statements by his wife, Jenny. What do you make of this?
This is a complete baseless argument. They have invented new standards for Justice Thomas and his wife about his wife's political activity. Jenny Thomas is a great American. She has been a conservative activist since long before she met Clarence Thomas. She doesn't do anything in the legal space. And there have been many judges and some justices that have had spouses that are in the either at law firms or in the public square. I'll just mention too quickly, Judge Reinhart out in the Ninth Circuit, his wife was the head of the ACLU Southern California chapter. She was the executive director for many years. And she was active on many, many issues that came before his court, both, you know, in terms of filing briefs and also making statements. And there was one famous case where the ACLU Southern California chapter filed a brief in the Proposition 8 same-sex ban on marriage that went up to the Ninth Circuit, and Stephen Reinhart heard the case. And he wrote an opinion saying why he didn't think it was necessary to recuse himself. His wife's views are her views. Mine are mine. And, you know, I'm not the reservoir of her views. And I actually agree with him on that opinion. But everyone applauded him for doing that and her for having this sort of marriage where you have working people pursuing their own work. But that's not how it gets applied to the Thomases. And there's another judge on the D.C. Circuit whose husband is the head of the ACLU, National Litigation, David Cole. And Judge Pillard is on the D.C. Circuit. He has commented on cases that have come directly before her. So the precedents and the law, in fact, support that Justice Thomas has not had to recuse himself from any of these cases. Just by way of Justice Ginsburg had a husband who was at a law firm when she was on the court and they had moved down from New York to Washington. He joined a Washington, D.C. law firm. That law firm appeared many times before the Supreme Court and she never recused herself from those cases. So I believe it's what Justice Thomas has been experienced his entire life. They're coming after his wife now to get to him, but it's a made-up standard of recusal that is just par for the course for the left to attack the Thomases. And then on the sort of January 6th stuff, Jenny Thomas raised concerns about elections like millions of Americans did. And there is no reason for Justice Thomas to recuse on any of those things. In fact, there was this stories going around that somehow he sat on a case where Jenny Thomas had text messages to Mark Meadows, and those were the documents at issue when Clarence ruled on a matter which was about Trump trying to assert executive privilege over some documents that Biden had decided to release from the Trump White House. Two things on that. Those text messages were already produced to the J6 committee long before Donald Trump filed his challenge in the Supreme Court. So I'm not sure what he was allegedly trying to protect since they were already produced. Second, those very documents wouldn't have been in the pile of documents that Trump was asserting privilege over, because those executive privilege only applies to communications between the president and his advisors, which are people kind of in the White House, his senior staff. And Jenny Thomas was never that. And so by their very nature, those documents wouldn't have been something that Trump would be able to assert executive privilege over. So these are the kind of things, somehow they get spun up by the press, and they're all designed to smear the Thomases, to try and force Justice Thomas to recuse himself. And it's unfortunate, but they've been living with this for 40 years. And now they're coming for Jenny, which is particularly, in my view, despicable. But they're strong, and they will get through this as they've gotten through everything else.
Finally, then, Justice Thomas says he doesn't think about his legacy. But you do. What do you think it will be?
A man of courage who was kind and humble and loved America and loved his family and friends. And I think that's what's most important to him. A job well done. He wants to get to heaven to be able to tell, or when he gets to heaven, to be able to tell his grandfather, I did my job. I did it the best. That's what he cares about most. I think why I wanted to have this movie made and worked on this book to bring it to publication is to get Justice Thomas's story out there so more people can learn about him and his faith, his resilience, his belief in America and the American story and the American opportunity, and to have an example for others to know that they can overcome obstacles. You know, there are a lot of obstacles in everyone's life and some more than others, but that you can succeed. And the most important thing is your family and your faith, and then that perseverance and work ethic to succeed.
Mark Paoletta formerly served as general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget and as chief counsel and assistant to Vice President Mike Pence. He's senior fellow at the Center for Renewing America and co-editor of the new book, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Mark, thank you very much. You've been very generous with your time.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Next hour, we'll look forward to Sunday morning, talking with Pastor David Peterson about Jesus' warning about judging others in Luke chapter 6. I'm Todd Wilkin, your link to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.